Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it's October 16th. This is Thursday afternoon, and we're almost done with the neurophysiology chapter. We're going to cover the central nervous system today, at least some parts of that chapter. It's kind of a review from anatomy, but we'll just go over it. Basically, what you have to know in the central nervous system are just the functions of the different parts of the brain that we're going to cover. All right, so let's see. Where's my folder at? Ah, here it is. Okay. And we're looking at, I believe, chapter 7. Yeah, so let's see. You probably got to be able to identify these neurons by their shape, whether it's multipolar, unipolar, bipolar. You got to be able to identify and then know those neurons by what their function is. The bipolar is sensory, and the unipolar is sensory, and the multipolar is either motor or association neuron. All right, so I think we got past all this kind of stuff. So maybe I'll just review real quick some of these things as it comes back to me. All right, so we were talking about nerves that use acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter. What do we call all the nerves that use acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter? Okay, close. Starts with a CH. They're called cholinergic neurons when they use acetylcholine. And when they use norepinephrine or epinephrine, they're called adrenergic. So those are two major kinds of neurons in the autonomic nervous system. They're either going to be cholinergic or adrenergic. And adrenergic comes from adrenaline, and cholinergic comes from acetylcholine. And adrenaline is just another name for epinephrine. And don't forget, then we have what? Noradrenaline. And that's the same thing as norepinephrine. Okay, so all of these right here are adrenergic, and acetylcholine is used in cholinergic neurons. So we'll be using that terminology. So what kind of system are we looking at here? Adrenergic or cholinergic? What kind of ligand-gated channels are these? These are cholinergic. Yeah, these are cholinergic because the signaling molecule is acetylcholine. And when you see this diagram, you should automatically think, well, gee whiz, you know, there are different kinds of cholinergic receptors. Right? There are nicotinic and muscarinic. And this one right here is an actual channel. This is the nicotinic type. And nicotinic types, when they bind two ligands, two acetylcholines, the sodium channel is predominantly a sodium channel, opens up, and sodium can enter the cell. And is that going to produce an IPSP or an EPSP? EPSP, right? So nicotinic type receptors are always going to be excitatory. They're always going to be excitatory. That's not necessarily the case for muscarinic receptors, right? Muscarinic are G protein coupled receptors, and depending on what the beta and gamma subunit bump into, whether it is a sodium channel or a potassium channel, a muscarinic receptor may be excitatory in some parts of the body and inhibitory on others. And if it's inhibitory, what kind of channel is operating? Potassium, because it's going to cause hyperpolarization. It's going to move that neuron farther away from threshold, and that's going to inhibit that neuron from from firing an action potential. And that's what we see in this particular case. So when we have a receptor mechanism or a signal transduction pathway that uses this G protein and it activates an ion channel, this is what we call ionotropic. All right, so this is an ionotropic mechanism because it's opening an ion channel. All right, and we saw how is the action of acetylcholine terminated in the synapse? Is it by reuptake or is it by degradation, enzymatic degradation? Okay, you know what? It's by enzymatic degradation because in the synaptic cleft there is acetylcholinesterase. And so here's acetylcholinesterase breaking down acetylcholine into acetate and choline. Acetate is taken back up into the presynaptic axon where it's reincorporated in with a choline to make acetylcholine and put back into a vesicle. Okay, other kinds of neurotransmitters. All right, so here we see cholinergic neurons use acetylcholine. Don't forget at the neuromuscular junction, anytime an action potential comes down a motor neuron, it always reaches a threshold potential on a... Okay, so what happened? It looks like it just turned off for some reason. It always causes an action potential on a muscle fiber, and the muscle fiber is always going to contract because the muscle fiber cannot decide, a skeletal muscle can't decide on its own whether or not it's going to contract. What decides whether or not a muscle fiber is going to contract is what? Is your mind. It's under voluntary control, right? So that's the overriding factor there. Oh, you know, I think we just lost the projector for sure. Something's happening. I have no idea what's happening. I can't remember if this happened last semester or not. Maybe it did. All right, it might not come on. Oh, okay. I don't know what it did now. Yeah. Okay, it looks like it's on. All right, well, let me think of some things to say as it's warming up or whatever it's doing. Okay, it's coming back. Searching.
Okay. What was the word you mentioned for the
adrenergic neurons? Adrenergic use norepinephrine as neurotransmitter.
That's the one you called that last one, the last figure, right?
And I think that was a...
Ionotropic,
here. Ion, that's an ion that's going to allow an ion to go across the membrane. And that's going to change the electrical properties of the cell. All right, and that's going to maybe cause an action potential or something.
You mentioned about the terminating.
Oh, yes. How is acetylcholine's action terminated within the synapse? And that is with an enzyme called acetylcholinesterase. Yeah, that's on there.
Oh, okay.
Okay, which is a different kind of mechanism than reuptake. All right.
Then the same thing?
Reuptake and degradation are two different things. Okay. Reuptake is when the neurotransmitter is just brought back into a cell and it's taken out of the synaptic cleft by that mechanism.
Okay, and then the other one is?
Just enzymatic degradation, because this is an enzyme.
Oh,
see that ASC right there? Yeah, it just breaks it down. Yeah. Yeah. Adrenaline is the same thing as epinephrine. Noradrenaline is the same thing as norepinephrine. So if it's a neurotransmitter, most cases it's going to be norepinephrine. That's the same thing as noradrenaline. And that's what we're going to talk about on one of the next slides. That's an adrenergic neuron. Not cholinergic. Because if it was cholinergic, it would use what as a neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so epinephrine and norepinephrine belong to these monoamine neurotransmitters. We looked at this, and don't forget that and serotonin is one of these, as well as dopamine. So serotonin is derived from tryptophan. Norepi and dopamine are derived from tyrosine. Both of these are amino acids, and these are essential amino acids. We talked about this, I'm sure, last time. That means that your body cannot make them. They have to be in your diet. And the easiest place to get these amino acids is in an animal protein, right? In meat, not in vegetables. So if you don't have these in your diet, then you can't make these important neurotransmitters. And it's been shown that serotonin and norepinephrine pathways, this adrenergic pathway and serotonin, play important roles in, for instance, clinical depression. So if someone has an improper diet, that could produce depression. All right, so that is interesting that there is a link between clinical depression and diet. All right, so we've talked about that slide. Now this one here, yeah. Okay, you see that. This shows a second messenger system operating with this this receptor, right? It's a G protein coupled receptor. And so in this particular case, after norepinephrine binds to the receptor molecule, the alpha subunit of the G protein can float around and it will bump into adenylate cyclase, and it will activate adenylate cyclase. That's an enzyme that can convert ATP into cyclic AMP, and cyclic AMP acts as a signaling molecule inside the cell. So the first messenger is what we call norepinephrine. The second messenger is cyclic AMP. And that changes the metabolism inside the cell, because cyclic AMP can activate certain enzymes, especially kinases, which then can phosphorylate other proteins, maybe activating them or inactivating them as well. It all depends on the particular enzyme. So this pathway right here, let's not pay attention to this ion channel, this pathway right here, where a signaling molecule changes the metabolism inside the cell but does not activate an ion channel, that's a different class, right? That's what we call metabotropic receptor. Because that kind of receptor doesn't necessarily open up or close an ion channel, it changes the metabolism inside the cell. And the way that it does that is through this second messenger, the production of cyclic AMP. Metabotropic. So in one circumstance, the ionotropic, it changes the electrical properties of the cell. And in the second example, it changes what? Metabolic pathways, activating or deactivating metabolic pathways in the cell. So this is just a general signal transduction scheme. The outside signal, what is the signal outside the cell? So it's a signal for changing metabolism. It's a signal for changing metabolism inside the cell. What's the signal that's going to change this metabolism inside the cell? The norepinephrine is a signal that is outside the cell. When it binds to the receptor, right through this G protein coupled receptor, it changes metabolism inside the cell via this messenger right here, which is cyclic AMP. That's the second messenger. So in most cases, the first messenger never enters the cell. It stays outside. And the second messenger never goes outside, it stays inside the cell. But nonetheless, they're linked together by this G protein and adenylate cyclase. And so we call this a metabotropic receptor, because it's changing metabolism inside the cell.
So we can the gamma beta?
Well, this whole G protein coupled receptor and adenylate cyclase. This is a metabotropic receptor system. All right, and I think what we were talking about last time is that when you activate adenylate cyclase, right, when the alpha unit bumps into adenylate cyclase, it's just an enzyme, and does an enzyme get used up in the reaction? Does not. So this can catalyze the reaction, the conversion of ATP into cyclic AMP hundreds of times or thousands of times, maybe even 10,000 of times. And how many norepinephrine molecules does this system here need in order to make thousands of cyclic AMPs, or a huge signal, just one little minuscule, right? So we're converting one signal into what? Thousands of signals inside the cell, so we call that amplification. And then that turns on this enzyme, protein kinase, and of course it stays active as well. So if you have thousands of cyclic AMPs that can turn on thousands of protein kinases, and each one of those can catalyze thousands of reactions, Right, so that is another step of amplification. So you have one step, another step, and maybe even a third step. That's what we call a cascade mechanism. So cascade mechanisms are typified by amplification, and also it can, and what is that? It means it can change something inside the cell very rapidly. It can change the whole nature of what's happening inside the cell very rapidly with just one signaling molecule outside the cell. So that's the importance of that kind of system. All right, so where did we leave off? I think we left off right here. Yeah, we were talking about dopamine, the basal nuclei. I guess maybe I'll just say a couple more things about norepinephrine. It's used both in the peripheral nervous system and central nervous system. Norepinephrine is the neurotransmitter in the postganglionic sympathetic nervous system. Does that ring a bell for anybody? Postganglionic sympathetic nervous system. If it doesn't, it will after we talk about the autonomic nervous system. But hopefully, hopefully from anatomy. Okay, projector. It's totally dead. Let me see if I can turn it back on. Yeah, but I think the plug is up in the ceiling someplace. None of us are that tall in here. Yeah, I could. Okay. Well, there's a chair. I could go from the floor to the chair to the table. Nothing's happening. Might have to all gather around the monitor. Ah! Okay, well, there's something bad happening with the projector. All right, so let's use it before it goes off, goes away again. Oh. okay, it's going to come back on. I know. All right, so we have what? Peripheral nervous system and central nervous system. And we're talking about norepinephrine. All right, so that's an adrenergic neuron because it's secreting norepinephrine. So in the peripheral nervous system, that is the sympathetic nerve. All right, what's the other kind? Parasympathetic. So norepinephrine does not work on any parasympathetic axons at all, just sympathetic, and also in the central nervous system. So norepinephrine is used in the central nervous system. And it is excitatory. It's an excitatory neurotransmitter in the central nervous system. And it just so happens that...
Only with the sympathetic?
No.
Norepinephrine.
No, norepinephrine, sympathetic in the peripheral nervous system, in the PNS, peripheral nervous system. But in the central nervous system, it's used in a number of pathways that are excitatory. And they can be stimulated with amphetamines. That's why amphetamine is an excitatory pharmacologic agent. All right, there can be some amino acid neurotransmitters, and some of these are very, very important neurotransmitters, like glutamic acid, aspartic acid. These are just amino acids, and glycine. Glutamate and aspartate are major excitatory neurotransmitters. And they're probably more important than acetylcholine in the central nervous system. Glycine is inhibitory. So how can you have an inhibitory? How would you maybe build a system to be inhibitory? An inhibitory ionotropic neurotransmitter. It's going to work through an ionotropic receptor.
For glycine?
Yeah, the glycine will. How would you describe how an excitatory neurotransmitter works? Okay, maybe. But if it's going to be excitatory, it's going to cause a stimulus, going to cause an EPSP. What kind of ion channel causes an EPSP? Like a sodium channel. Sodium enters the cell, depolarizes it. All right, but how would we inhibit that cell? Not by depolarizing, but by hyperpolarizing. I thought I could highlight it, but I can't. Okay, by hyperpolarizing the membrane. How do you know of how to hyperpolarize a membrane? So here's a membrane. Give me some ions. What's high on the outside? Sodium is high on the outside. What else? Chlorine is high on the outside. And calcium is high on the outside. What's high on the inside?
Potassium.
All right, so what's a typical way that we would depolarize the membrane? Making what go where?
Sodium
going in. We'll depolarize. How about if we let calcium go in?
Depolarize.
That's going to depolarize as well. All right, so what about if chlorine goes in? Because it has an opposite sign, it's going to have an opposite effect compared to sodium and calcium. Right, so if we take a negative charge and put it in an area, what's the charge in a resting cell? It's negative on the inside, so if we take chlorine, which is negative, and put it on the inside, that makes the inside even more negative. That's what? Hyperpolarization. And when we hyperpolarize a membrane, that takes it farther away from threshold, and that inhibits that neuron, right? So that's how glycine works. Strychnine is a toxin that blocks glycine receptors, and it causes spastic paralysis. Any kind of stimulation, any kind of touch, somebody that's poisoned with strychnine, any kind of sound or touch on their body, any kind of stimulation is going to stimulate all the neurons, and none of these neurons are going to be inhibited because these glycine pathways are blocked. A person is just going to go into complete total paralysis. All the muscles in their body are going to contract because of pathways in the spinal cord that are being stimulated, and none are being inhibited as a result. Gamma-aminobutyric acid is the most common neurotransmitter in the brain. That's an amino acid. It also works by opening chlorine channels, so these are inhibitory. Okay, so I think maybe you should get a little bit of an impression that our nervous system has excitatory pathways and inhibitory pathways, and you might wonder, well, why do we have all these different pathways? But what's a real important concept in a physiology class? Probably the most important thing, and that is, yeah, maintaining homeostasis. Another way of saying that is maintaining balance and precise control. And what kind of mechanisms allow you balance and precise control? Is it a tonic mechanism or an antagonistic? Yeah, when you have two mechanisms that work in opposition to each other, the way that your body maintains balance is by using both of those systems when they work in opposition to each other to reach the set point, okay, in a very nice balanced way. So you have to have excitatory as well as inhibitory pathways in the central nervous system. As a matter of fact, I think we might be aware, for instance, when some children are hyperactive, they're actually given amphetamines. So how would you explain if somebody is hyperactive, why do we give them something that will stimulate certain parts of their nervous system? Because what parts of the nervous system are we really trying to stimulate, bring back into balance? If somebody is hyperactive, we need to stimulate the inhibitory pathways. And that's what amphetamine does, okay? And these not maybe all amphetamines, but what are some things? Like, I guess, Ritalin stimulates the inhibitory pathways, which decreases hyperactivity. Okay, then instead of amino acids, sometimes neuropeptides, when we put amino acids together, they can work as neurotransmitters. They don't work through ion channels, but they work to change metabolism inside the cell. So these would be what? Metabotropic kinds of receptors, not ionotropic kinds of receptors. And so they would work through some kind of second messenger system in the brain. Other kinds of neuropeptides, pain is mediated by substance P. All right, and would you want to just have pain pathways? What other kind of pathways in order to establish balance in the body should you have? You should have, of course, pathways that can carry signals of pain or discomfort or tissue damage throughout your body so that you have the appreciation of tissue damage. But what else is important? Having an antagonistic system to bring that into balance. And the antagonistic system uses endorphins and enkephalins and dynorphins. These are endogenous opioid neurotransmitters that promote analgesia. All right, so these will break the effects or moderate the effects of substance P in the body. And that's where opium comes in, because opium is an alkaloid that has basically the same kind of shape as these natural opioids that are produced by the body. And they will bind to the same receptors. There are other compounds that have similar shapes, like naloxone right here has a similar shape to these endorphins and enkephalins. But this will poison the receptors. It will bind to the receptors and block the action of opioids. And so this sometimes is given to heroin addicts to block the effect of their addiction within their central nervous system. All right, I don't know if I'm going to say anything about these. This is just sort of interesting from the standpoint that there are not very many lipid neurotransmitters. Most are water-soluble. but one, in particular, the endocannabinoids, and this is similar in structure to tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the active component in marijuana. And what part of the cell has a lot of lipids? Not an adipocyte, but just a normal cell. Where do we find lipids in a normal cell? In particular, phospholipids. Within the membrane, right? So the inner part of the membrane actually acts as a reservoir for lipid molecules that can be converted into signaling molecules via the activation of some enzymes that will actually use parts of the membrane to be and convert them into neurotransmitters. Some of these neurotransmitters, so they're not stored in vesicles, but they're just produced by enzymes that get activated when they act on the plasma membrane. And some of these neurotransmitters are retrograde. So what do we mean about retrograde? Antrograde means that a signal goes from the presynaptic neuron to the postsynaptic neuron. But retrograde means that when they're released from the presynaptic neuron, they actually work on the presynaptic neuron, somehow modulating their activity. So they work on the neuron that actually secretes them. So we call those a retrograde neurotransmitter. And remember, that was a process that I said really never happened. Signals always go from the presynaptic neuron into the postsynaptic neuron, and really never backwards, because the presynaptic neuron doesn't have receptors and the postsynaptic neuron doesn't have synaptic vesicles. But now we know that actually it's a little bit more complicated than that, and that is some neurotransmitters actually go back to the cell that releases them to alter metabolism inside that cell. But because this is a lipid neurotransmitter, where would you guess these receptors are? Are they in the plasma membrane, or are they inside the cell? I think we maybe talked about this in terms of generally signaling molecules. If they were hydrophobic, where are the receptors at? But if they were hydrophilic, there's another location inside the cell for these receptors. Okay, so if they're hydrophobic, they can get through the membrane. They can dissolve through the membrane because they're lipid, so there are receptors inside the cell. If they're hydrophilic, they can't get through the membrane. They can't get through the phospholipid bilayer, so the receptors have to be on the plasma membrane, on the outside of the plasma membrane someplace. And then there are even some gas neurotransmitters, nitric oxide and carbon monoxide. These all act through a cyclic GMP second messenger system instead of a cyclic AMP second messenger system. Nitric oxide causes relaxation of smooth muscle. In some cases, they might act as a retrograde neurotransmitter, that meaning what they act on the cell that releases them. And this is the pathway or the neurotransmitter system that Viagra works with. Viagra causes relaxation of smooth muscle around the vasculature inside the penis, and as that vasculature relaxes, then blood pools in that part of the body and what's produced. Nobody knows. Okay. All right. Well, let's look at synaptic integration. This is the last part of this chapter right here. And synaptic integration just refers to how different kinds of signals, and we know two kinds of signals, how they interact, how a neuron integrates them up to either produce or not produce an action potential. And those were either EPSPs or IPSPs. All right. So here we have a nice picture of membrane potential versus time of this neuron right here. And we see this is actually a pretty interesting picture, because here we see dendrites and cell body of a postsynaptic neuron. Yeah. And we see the axon. Wonder what were to happen if I were to just smack it. Where's my smacker at? Here. Nobody's sitting underneath it, right? What about these cables? They're tight. What about this cable? Ah, what about the power? No, the little light is on, so it's got power. It's just freaking out. Okay. That's the power button. Oh, I know, but I don't want to fall off the chair. I'll put this right here so that it can see it. Okay. Maybe it's overheating. Maybe somebody left it on. I don't remember turning it on when we came in. Okay, that's probably off. Or is that on? No, that's on. It's turning off. Okay. Maybe it's overheating and it's turning itself off. In focus. Oh, that's a new one. That's a new thing. I never saw that before. Okay. So here we have a slide that shows membrane potential versus time on this neuron right here. And we can see dendrites, cell body, and an axon. And so what's this part of the axon right here? Axon hillock. We also consider that the trigger zone. Right, so the cell body and dendrites is where, this is the receiving end of a neuron. This is where we have ligand-gated channels. And right at this region right here, this is the first place where we have voltage-gated channels. Okay, so, and these arrows down here represent relative amounts of excitatory neurotransmitter that's going to be released at these synapses, here, 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 and here. Right, or let's just think that there's only one. Let's just say it's this one right here, and this is a nice axosomatic synapse, because it's the end of an axon synapsing on the cell body or the soma of a neuron. And with a relatively little amount of excitatory neurotransmitter released right here, that's going to produce a relatively small graded potential. And how can you tell me, describe this stimulation right here? Describe this EPSP for me. Is it going to cause an action potential? No. I would like to know, and why not? Well, how come it's not going to? It hasn't reached the threshold. So what I was looking for is that you would say, well, this is a sub-threshold EPSP, right? Okay, so the rate of action potentials reaching this nerve terminus right here is not sufficient to cause the release of a lot of neurotransmitter, excitatory neurotransmitter. And if we increase the rate of action potentials coming down this axon, that's going to increase the amount of excitatory neurotransmitter. That's going to then increase the stimulus strength, right? So graded potentials are all different in amplitude. It's not like an action potential. It just depends on the amount of neurotransmitter that's released at this particular synapse. Okay. Then finally, all right, we send a signal down this axon, which is very high frequency action potentials, and now we release a lot of neurotransmitter. So how would you describe this third EPSP? Yeah, that's certainly a threshold graded potential, and when that graded potential reaches the trigger zone right here, since it's that threshold, that's going to switch a bunch of voltage-gated sodium channels open, right, which is going to cause an action potential that's going to move down this axon. All right, so these graded potentials have no threshold. The height of this stimulation right here is just directly related to the amount of neurotransmitter that's released at the synapse. And there is no refractory period. One graded potential can come right after another, or even right on top of one. Right, so they can summate, so they have no refractory period, they can have different heights. And don't forget, as they travel over a dendrite and cell body, they actually reduce in amplitude. So they travel with decrement. And that is all completely different compared to an action potential, right? An action potential always has the same height, has a refractory period. So right here, we can never stimulate another action potential. We would have to wait for the refractory period to end. And then the other thing, too, as this action potential moves down this axon, let's build a really big neuron. Let's build a neuron that starts here in this room, and it goes around the moon and back. So that's a really long neuron. What is that action potential when it's like when it starts in the room compared to when it goes around the moon and comes back over here? What's the difference? It's going to be exactly the same, right? Okay. As long as it's a nice healthy neuron. Okay. Because it's self-propagating. Action potentials travel without decrement. All right. Well, what about spatial summation? Here we have one postsynaptic neuron and we have two presynaptic neurons. And both of these are going to, these are both excitatory presynaptic neurons. And when the first one, what we're going to do is we're going to do two different experiments. The first experiment, only the first neuron is going to be stimulated, the first presynaptic neuron. And then in the second experiment, both the first, number one, and number two presynaptic neurons will be stimulated at the same time. So if we stimulate just the first number one presynaptic neuron, that's going to release a certain amount of neurotransmitter on this dendrite right here, and it's going to cause an EPSP. But again, how would you talk about this EPSP right here? It's EPSP because it's causing depolarization, right? And then when it flows down to this axon hillock, what's going to happen? Okay, but don't forget, in order for this to cause an action potential, this EPSP has to at least reach threshold. So does it reach threshold?
No.
It's sub-threshold, right? So it cannot cause an action potential. But if we stimulate both neuron number one and neuron number two at the same time, to where now they both release excitatory neurotransmitter. Here is the stimulus from neuron number one. Here's the stimulus from neuron number two. Notice that they can add together, right? So they constructively interfere with each other. They add together. And now what do you have? You have a threshold potential. All right, so this neuron right here is integrating information from both of these neurons to decide whether or not an action potential will be transmitted down the postsynaptic neuron. So this is an example of spatial summation. All right, temporal summation can work the same way, but in this particular case, it doesn't necessarily happen because there are multiple neurons synapsing on the postsynaptic neuron, but it's just because one neuron is being stimulated to produce many EPSPs that are spaced very closely in time. And so the second EPSP comes along before the first one actually goes away altogether. Right? So the first EPSP is produced and it looks like this. And then it's going to do what? It's going to fade away. But before it fades away, let's just say that another graded potential takes place. Right, so it's going to kind of look like that, right? But maybe not quite so much. Maybe it's going to look like that, right? Because don't forget, this first one is fading away too. So if that reaches threshold, then of course that's going to cause an action potential. So both temporal summation and spatial summation can occur to produce a threshold stimulus. When we use a synapse repeatedly, this can increase or decrease the ease of transmission. In most cases, it eases the ease of transmission across the synapse. We would call that synaptic facilitation. But if it decreases the ease of transmission across the synapse, that would be called synaptic depression. And any kind of stimulation normally would create synaptic facilitation, especially high-frequency stimulation, causes enhanced excitability across a synapse. All right, and this is what we call long-term potentiation. And when us, so if we have a pre- and post-synaptic neuron, so here we have one neuron, and then a second neuron, when one action potential reaches the axon terminus, it's going to release some neurotransmitter. Let's just say, yeah, okay, great. One bolus of excitatory neurotransmitter, and maybe that's going to be, right? Maybe that's going to be a subthreshold stimulus. But with repeated use of this synapse, okay, even though there's maybe one action potential, now this synapse gets more efficient and it releases more neurotransmitter. So what happens to this graded potential when there's more neurotransmitter being released right here? Even though it's just one action potential, right? So now we have a greater, a higher magnitude graded potential, and of course then that's going to stimulate an action potential on this second neuron over here, right? So the first time when this synapse was used, right, it didn't pass the information along, but subsequent uses of this synapse right here, it becomes more efficient, and the signal gets passed around, gets passed through the synapse. So this synapse becomes more efficient with repetition, and that is one way that we can explain learning, how it is that synapses in our mind get more efficient the more we use them. Because synaptic transmission is facilitated with use of a synapse. Okay. Who's got my ruler? Ah, here it is. So I'm going to have to make a call, I guess. Because this would be really boring to do this all semester long. All right, and as a matter of fact, talking about learning in the brain probably likes to do one thing more than anything else, and that actually is to learn things. So whenever we stimulate our brain, synapses are facilitated. So it's easier to appreciate that second stimulus or third stimulus, or to elicit a memory. The more that you practice, maybe I turned it off. Oh, blinking. I see a red flashing light. And it's green?
No, red.
Don't do it. Ah. Now it's green. So maybe it's coming back on. Okay, so I was saying that in the brain likes to do something, one thing more than anything else, and that is to learn. And that has some really important clinical implications on how we like to treat patients. For instance, there is a condition called epilepsy, in which action potentials, there is usually one part of the brain that depolarizes, and that depolarization travels over the whole brain, stimulating the whole brain, causing an epileptic seizure. And that stimulates what the motor cortex and the person's muscles are going to contract, and they can't control how they're breathing or swallowing or anything. And of course, it's a pretty dangerous condition, having an epileptic seizure. And we know that we need to treat that condition very aggressively. That means not put somebody on a little amount of medication or wait to see if that seizure is going to happen again. We know that we should give them a very adequate, very strong dose of anti-seizure medication, and maybe from then on in their life. Because what we realize now is that once the brain has produced an epileptic seizure by depolarizing and sending depolarization all over the brain, it actually learns how to do that, so that the next time it takes less of a stimulus, and the third time even less of a stimulus to produce an epileptic seizure. So the best way to protect somebody's brain is to what? Keep their brain from learning how to produce an epileptic seizure. Right? So it's very important to treat somebody that has epilepsy very early on. okay, to prevent their brains from learning how to produce a seizure. And of course, from our perspective, it's very, you know, it's counterintuitive that a brain would learn how to do that, but the brain doesn't know that it's learning the wrong behavior, right? And the same thing is true for many other kinds of disease processes, for instance, like clinical depression. We've learned to treat, and it's best to treat clinical depression aggressively from the very first onset, because again, the brain learns how to produce the depressed state of mind in a person. So usually the first case of a clinical depression is precipitated by an event in somebody's life, right? And then if depression reoccurs in that person, the stimulus doesn't have to be as great. It can be a lesser traumatic experience. In the third case, even a lesser traumatic experience that wouldn't have triggered the first episode of depression. And then finally later on, depression can just afflict somebody without a precipitating tragic event at all. So that's all kind of interesting. So the best way to treat depression, and I think I should learn how to do that with projectors too, prevent that first case of turning off automatically. Okay. So as far as the brain learning, a lot of these things we like to prevent the brain from learning what to do. It seemed to stay on longer when I used the clicker. You know, I wish it would just die altogether, because then somebody could fix it. But if it works some of the time, you can help me with that. Good. If it's working when somebody comes in to fix it, of course they can't fix it. Okay. Oh, right, right. Oh, come on. Looks like it was coming back. I think I only had one more slide. To show you. All right, so next time I'll have to bring in a projector. All right, one last concept that was on this slide right here, synaptic plasticity. All right, what that refers to is that plasticity just means that the structure of the brain can change. When somebody learns something, okay, maybe not only do you have increased numbers of synaptic vesicles in a synapse that can be released with a certain stimulation, right, therefore providing for facilitated synaptic transmission, but the number of synapses between neurons can increase or decrease. So for instance, with repeated use of this pathway, there might be collaterals that come off this main axon and a collateral over here. So now you have maybe three synapses or four synapses where before you only had one synapse. So when one action potential comes down this axon, now you have what? Three or four times the amount of neurotransmitter that's being released, producing three or four times the amount of graded potentials on the postsynaptic neuron here. Okay, so we call that synaptic plasticity. And again, that's something that happens in a learning process. When you use certain pathways in your brain actually grows and changes, sets out and grows collaterals, and facilitates synaptic transmission. So a good way of thinking of that is when you use a muscle, what happens to that muscle? Yeah, it flexes. No, it contracts. Okay, it contracts, and the other one relaxes. But what about that muscle that's contracting? Not about, don't tell me anything about the one that's relaxing. But the one that's contracting, what's happening to it? It's getting tired, but what about tomorrow? What's going to happen to it? It's going to get bigger and stronger. It's going to respond to that stressful stimulus. What about bone? What happens if you start stressing a bone? What's going to happen to it? Okay, it's going to break, but I tell you what, you know, what am I stressing? I'm stressing my radius over here because my biceps inserts into the radius, right? And so I pull on the radius, and just as the muscle is hypertrophying and getting stronger, that bone is getting bigger and stronger too, Because there are what? They're living cells. What are the name of those living cells inside bone? Osteocytes, right? Bone is not just like concrete that we have in a building. So when you stress a bone, it gets bigger and stronger. And that's the reason why exercise is so important in preventing osteoporosis. Because in your lifetime, you can get bones to be bigger and stronger by exercise. Right? So anytime you use a tissue properly, it gets bigger and stronger. When you use your brain because of synaptic plasticity, right, it doesn't swell up, it doesn't get bigger, but it gets stronger and it gets smarter because it changes the structure. Your brain structure is actually changing. So when you take a class like an anatomy class or a physiology class and you're cramming all this information, different ways of thinking of things, learning new vocabulary, what's actually happening to your brain? It's being restructured. Synapses, it's becoming overwhelmed, did you say? It's being overworked, okay? But if there's new synapses that are forming, there's new collateral axons, okay? And that's why sometimes when you're taking a class, the last part of the class is actually easier than the first part because your brain is changing and you're learning how to think with these new concepts and new ideas. Okay, synaptic inhibition. How can synaptic inhibition take place? Well, it all depends that with these two neurons right here, these two presynaptic neurons, maybe one is going to release an excitatory neurotransmitter, and the second one right here is going to release an inhibitory neurotransmitter. Right? So GABA and glycine produce IPSPs. IPSPs dampen the excitatory postsynaptic potentials, making it harder to reach thresholds. So for instance, if neuron number one releases inhibitory neurotransmitter, maybe opening up a chlorine channel or opening up a potassium channel, that's going to produce an IPSP. And then if the second neuron is excitatory, if it releases neurotransmitter before the IPSP disappears, these are going to summate, but they're going to cancel out. So now this EPSP from neuron number two over here can't reach threshold. But if this EPSP was produced back here at resting membrane potential, it would have reached threshold, right? So this is what we call synaptic inhibition, when there is a neuron releasing inhibitory neurotransmitter. So that's what we call postsynaptic inhibition, because it's happening in what? The postsynaptic neuron. It's happening in this neuron right here. But there's also something called presynaptic inhibition, which I don't show you on this slide, but I'll show you on this one right here. So let's look at these connections, the anatomical connections, the neuroanatomy. So these red cells, and are all these red? I think these are all red. Are these all red? All these presynaptic cells, right?
They're brown.
Okay, they're brown. The projector is changing color on me. These brown ones right here. All right, these are all the presynaptic neurons, and what do we see? One, two, three, we see four presynaptic neurons, and we see one postsynaptic neuron, which is yellow. All right, and we see different kinds of synapses. Like here is a synapse from one axon to this dendrite. Anybody know what kind of synapse that is called? You have to learn that in anatomy. This one right here, right where this funny cursor is, that's what we call an axo, because here's the axon. So this is an axodendritic synapse, because it synapses on a dendrite. This one right here is an axosomatic synapse, because it's synapsing on the soma, or the cell body of the postsynaptic neuron. Right? So axodendritic, axosomatic. And these right here, this axodendritic and this axosomatic, are producing IPSPs, right? That's going to produce postsynaptic inhibition in this postsynaptic neuron right here. This one, I think is probably excitatory because it's not labeled as inhibitory. This is going to cause, what, EPSPs in the postsynaptic neuron. And here is another excitatory axon coming down through here. So here is an axodendritic synapse, and here's maybe another axodendritic synapse. This is going to release excitatory neurotransmitter causing EPSPs at these two synapses right here. But notice there is one more kind of synapse that I haven't pointed out yet. There is a synapse right here in this circle. And this one here is called an axonic synapse. Because where does it synapse? It synapses on an axon of a presynaptic cell. So you got to see that, otherwise I don't think the discussion is going to make sense. You see that this synapse, the axon terminus of one neuron is actually synapsing on the axon of a neighboring neuron. Okay? And this one right here is going to release inhibitory neurotransmitter. It's going to cause an IPSP. All right? Too bad this one over here isn't labeled too. But this is going to release, for instance, maybe something that's going to open up a chlorine channel or a potassium channel. And when you open up that kind of channel in this part of an axon, right, that's going to hyperpolarize the membrane, and that can be enough to block an action potential from flowing over this area right here. All right, so if you block an action potential, you're going to inhibit the neuron. And where is this neuron, where is this synapse being inhibited? It's, or the inhibitory action is proximal to the synapse. So we call this presynaptic inhibition. So presynaptic inhibition. So there are different ways that neuronal circuits can regulate themselves. Postsynaptic inhibition, when we mix together IPSPs and EPSPs, or presynaptic inhibition, when we even inhibit the presynaptic neuron, okay, with an axoaxonic synapse that is inhibitory. Okay. And I think that's the last slide in this chapter. All right, so we want to go to 8, central nervous system. All right, let me see if we can. So this is just a nice review of some anatomy. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this chapter. Okay, but the central nervous system, you know, is made up of the brain and the spinal cord. And that's what we see right here in the meninges around it and cerebral spinal fluids in the subarachnoid space. The central nervous system receives input from sensory neurons. And inside the central nervous system, there are association neurons that integrate that information up and maybe compare it to set point information. Those association or interneurons then make a decision on what to do with that sensory information and send it out through a motor neuron to some kind of effector organ. The central nervous system also performs learning and memory kinds of functions when we adjust synapses and make them more efficient. In the central nervous system, we have gray matter and white matter. Gray matter is just nerve cell bodies and dendrites that's not myelinated. White matter are myelinated axons. Okay. The cerebrum, that's the largest part of the brain. And you should know the different lobes. There are 5 major lobes. Usually we can see 4 of them pretty easily. Frontal lobe, parietal, right, occipital, temporal. And then the 5th lobe is really deep to the brain. We'd actually have to pull this temporal lobe away to see the insula. That's the inner lobe of the brain. And in order for you to have conscious perception of your reality, these are the neurons that have to depolarize. Neurons within the cerebral cortex have to depolarize, and that gives you the perception of reality. Depolarization of neurons and other parts of the brain are real important for maintaining homeostasis and maybe for learning, regulating different parts of your body, but that's not going to rise to the level of consciousness. You won't have an appreciation of what's going on there. Okay. And even the right and left hemispheres have different functions. So we can see that the right and left hemispheres are separated by this very deep longitudinal fissure. Okay. And we can see that the longitudinal fissure goes all the way down to the corpus callosum right here. Right? And so the corpus callosum has certain kinds of tracts that are moving from the right hemisphere to the left hemisphere. Does anybody know what those tracts are called that go from one side of the brain to the other? They're neurological pathways. This is true. They're called commissural pathways. Commissural pathways, right? All right, so the corpus callosum is loaded with commissural pathways that are sharing information between the right and left hemispheres of the cerebrum. The surface of the cerebrum is highly convoluted. That means that it is made up of folds. And because it's just the surface area of the brain, the number of neurons right on the surface of the cerebral cortex that give us the perception of reality and intelligence. And in order to fit something that has a big surface area into a small space, what do you have to do? You got to fold it up. You got to bend it up, right? And that forms a convolution. So a convolution has two parts. It's got a depression, which is what we call a sulcus, and it's got a gyrus, which is a ridge. And so you put those two together, that's a convolution. And all these convolutions have names, but you should probably be aware of two gyri and at least one sulcus. The sulcus that is separating the frontal lobe from the parietal lobe is called the central sulcus. The gyrus just anterior to the central sulcus is the precentral gyrus. And the gyrus just posterior to the central sulcus is the postcentral gyrus. All right, so let's talk about some of the function of the frontal lobe. Okay, so the frontal lobe, especially this more posterior part of the frontal lobe, this is what we call the primary motor cortex. Whenever you make some kind of voluntary movement in your body using skeletal muscle, these neurons depolarize first. Right, so this is what initiates some kind of voluntary motion in your body, depolarization of neurons in the precentral gyrus. But when the neurons in the postcentral gyrus depolarize, it doesn't produce motion. It produces sensation. Okay, so the frontal lobe, we consider the motor lobe of the brain because it's sending signals out, but the parietal lobe is receiving signals from the periphery. Especially in the postcentral gyrus, it's receiving signals from the surface of your body, right? Somatic sensation. And the temporal lobe and occipital lobe are kind of posterior as well. The occipital lobe is important for vision. So it is sensory, but it is vision. The temporal lobe is sensory, but it is for olfaction and for hearing. The primary auditory cortex is right in this part of the temporal lobe, right about here. So those are some important things that you should know. So here we have a nice diagram. All right, so here is anterior, here is posterior, and so this is the frontal lobe, here's parietal lobe, there's that central sulcus. Ooh, bless you. Here's the precentral gyrus. So what did we say the precentral gyrus was good for? That's your motor, that's your primary motor cortex. How are you going to memorize that the frontal lobe's function is primarily motor? Because why? Okay. Left, because you think of like left and right? Okay. Okay. I'll have to think about that.
And just,
okay. I'll have to sleep on that one, okay? And I usually wake up with good ideas, so I'm looking forward to that. I don't know what to say about that. Okay, signals decussate over, okay, from the contralateral side. I don't know, I have a little easier way of remembering that the frontal lobe is motor, okay? Because in your automobile, where's the motor? It's in the front. Unless you have a motor in the back, then that doesn't work. You might have a car that has a motor in the back. All right, so the frontal lobe is the motor lobe. Now, does anybody have a car that has a motor right in the middle, either front or the back? No? You do? Oh. Yeah, okay, well, none of you could be my friends. But if you had a car with a motor in the middle, you could be my friend because they're really expensive, fancy cars. I'm just kidding. Okay, yeah, German and really fancy cars. Okay, but most motors are in the front. So just remember, this precentral gyrus is the primary motor cortex, and the primary sensory cortex is the postcentral gyrus. So let's make a nice, pretty much a coronal section through these two different parts of the brain, the precentral gyrus and the postcentral gyrus. So a coronal section of the precentral gyrus is going to be this nice yellow color, and the postcentral gyrus is going to be this blue color right here. And what do you see mapped out on the surface of the brain? I see a little cartoon figure. All right, I see a little head with eyeballs and a nose and a tongue and a hand, an arm, a trunk, and a leg right here. All right, I see a little cartoon figure. This is what we call a homunculus person. And this just shows you how the surface of the brain maps out to the surface of your body. So if we were to stimulate this area right here, as opposed to this area over here, what would happen? Okay, so yellow, don't forget, yellow is coming from the precentral gyrus. So is this a sensory area or motor area? Motor. Right, so if we actually stimulate this with some electrical current, what's going to happen to this person? Their nose is going to wiggle, or their cheek is going to wiggle. Right, because these neurons right here, when they depolarize, initiate motor activity in this part of a person's body. Or if we stimulate this part of the precentral gyrus, what's going to happen? They're going to stick their tongue out at you or swallow or do something, because these are the motor neurons that control swallowing and speech. Right? Or if we stimulate this part of the cerebral cortex, what's going to happen? Well, they might flip you off, right? Because that's the hand right there. Or if we stimulate this part, all right, what might happen? They might contract their orbicularis oculi muscle, right? They might wink at you. Okay. And then if we stimulate the other side at the same time, then both eyes are going to close. Okay. So this is how the surface of the body maps out to the surface of your brain. And then if we go to the postcentral gyrus and we depolarize these neurons in this part of the cerebral cortex, what's going to happen? That was the lips. What's going to happen when we stimulated that area right there? Okay. Ah, but it was the blue one. What's blue? Sensory. So if we stimulate those neurons in the brain, that person is going to have the sensation of, you know, something tickling or pressure or pain or something on their lips. Okay. Some kind of sensation on the lips. Now, when you did a two-point discrimination, I hope that slide comes back. When you did a two-point discrimination, what part of your body had the highest two-point discrimination, which meant the closest? You could bring the pins closest together and still tell it was two pins and not just one pin sticking here. It was the lips if you did it, and if you didn't do the lips, you would have said fingertips. Okay, fingertips are really good, okay, but the lips even have better two-point discrimination. Right? You might want to go back and do that one. What's going on? Wow, that was really bizarre. Okay. All right, so in that area of the cerebral cortex, you have more neurons covering a smaller surface area on your body, so you have better discrimination. All right, it's coming back. World leader. Oh, I hate to get a bad projector. Okay. So where's another place that has really high discrimination? Tongue and, of course, your hands. Right? So you have a high density of receptors, not very much in your elbow and arms, not very much in your leg, maybe a little bit in your feet over here. Your trunk, hardly any at all. This is a large surface area on the surface of your body, but not on the surface of your brain. Okay, so that's really important to know. And it's real important for surgical planning. Maybe somebody has a brain tumor right here, and there's a surgeon that's got to figure out how to get to that brain tumor. Do you want to go in, like, right through here? Or do you maybe go in right through here? You go in through a part of the brain that doesn't contain very many important functions. And sometimes even during the surgery, they actually map these areas out, because this is a pretty crude diagram, right? And they'll even stimulate a part of the brain and see if something moves or not. And if it's an important motion, then that's definitely not a part of the brain that a surgeon wants to destroy. They'll want to preserve that kind of function. Okay. So that's pretty important. Okay, temporal lobe, primary auditory cortex, occipital lobe, primary visual cortex. The insula plays an important role in memory, and the insula is deep to the temporal lobe. Okay, special function. I think we talked about the basal nuclei once before. All right, so we've made a nice transverse cut in the brain, pretty much at the level of the thalamus. And we see gray matter right on the surface of the brain, nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And deeper in the cerebral cortex, we see white matter. So these are all tracts going someplace. So tracts that go from the right to the left hemisphere are what we call, starts with a C, commissural tracts, right? Commissural tracts. And this would be part of the corpus callosum right here. So the corpus callosum is a way for the right and left hemispheres of the brain to share information. These darker areas right here don't contain tracts. Well, this is the thalamus right here. That's a relay station for sensory information going to the cerebral cortex. So a third order neuron is going to go from the thalamus to the cerebral cortex for sensory perception. But these other dark areas right here are nuclei inside the brain. And what's a nucleus again? It's just gray matter, which is nerve cell bodies and dendrites sharing information. These are what we call the basal nuclei, and they're involved in coordinating voluntary muscle movement. And they're deep inside the brain. And these are the nuclei that use dopamine as a neurotransmitter. And this system is important because our musculoskeletal system is built up on antagonism, right? And that just means that if I contract this biceps right here, I have to relax another muscle. What's the muscle that I have to relax in order to contract my biceps? That's the triceps. So if they both contract at the same time, what is the motion going to be like? Hardly any at all. Or if my biceps is stronger, it's going to be very rigid, awkward, okay, very staccatoed kind of motion. Right, so it's the job of these basal nuclei to relax the opposite muscle, the antagonistic muscle, so that you have fluid motion. So when people have damage to the basal nuclei, some kind of lesion, could be a functional lesion, maybe these neurons have forgotten how to synthesize dopamine, or for whatever reason can't synthesize dopamine anymore, which is the neurotransmitter at the synapse, right, then the antagonistic muscles won't be relaxed, and somebody's going to be very rigid. And that condition is what we call Parkinson's disease. Okay, so somebody with Parkinson's disease can't walk. Oh yeah, I'm sure we talked about this already, right? Okay, so that involves these basal nuclei right here. Not the thalamus, but the basal nuclei. Okay. Cerebral lateralization just refers to the specialization that each hemisphere has. So the hemispheres don't perform the same kind of motion. They're not identical. All right? So this, and also, the cerebral hemispheres controls movement on the opposite side of the body, and furthermore, the opposite hemispheres receive sensory information from the opposite side of the body. But nonetheless, it's important for the two cerebral hemispheres to share information, and they can share information via the corpus callosum and other kinds of commissural tracts that go between the two hemispheres. So for instance, if we look at kind of a transverse section of the brain, all right, this is anterior and posterior, all right, olfaction is processed. So these are not the primary centers, but these are the higher association areas inside the brain. We have olfaction, and that looks pretty much identical on either side of the brain. But speech and writing, right, is predominantly on the right side of the brain, right? We don't have, let me look at this little note right here. What does that say? L-E-W. I don't know what L-E-W means. All right, so speech and writing on the left side of the brain, but not on the right side. The main language center, okay, is on the left side, as well as your mathematical abilities are on the left side of the brain, not on the right side. All right, so for instance, it's important that the sides of the brain share information. Because, for instance, if I were to tell somebody, especially in their right ear, a couple numbers, like I could say in the right ear, number 1 and number 2, very softly, so the left ear couldn't hear it, And then I can say, add those two numbers together. Well, where's that information at? It's in the right side of the brain, right? And then it has to be shared through the corpus callosum to the left side to where you add up those two numbers. So what would the answer be? Okay, very good. But now if somebody has a lesion in the corpus callosum, you can tell them those two numbers over here. They can't get across. They couldn't tell you what the two numbers added up to. It's not that they can't add. It's just that they can't get the information from the other side of the brain. So you can get all kinds of very strange, anomalous effects when there are different lesions in the brain at different locations. Okay, so the right side of the brain is best at visual spatial tasks. The left hemisphere possesses, what, language skills. Okay, there are a couple other areas in the brain that are important for speech. And speech has different components. It has the sensory component as well as a motor component, right? So to understand speech is one modality, but to speak is a whole different modality, and it requires different parts of the brain. So where do you hear language? Primary auditory cortex, right? You hear sounds. So this area right here is hearing sounds. It doesn't know if it's language or not, and it's going to share that information with higher centers of the brain. So this is what we call an association area of the brain, where the information of perception is used to ascertain meaning. But when you partake with language or when you listen to language, it's not just what you hear, especially if it's a person-to-person communication. It's also what you are seeing, what you're visualizing, right? So I'm sure you've heard it's not really what you say that connotates a meaning. It's really how you say something. And not just that, but the visual expression that you have on your face when you're communicating that information, right? So I suppose I could give you an example. I could say the same thing two different ways to one person, and it will have two completely different meanings. Like I could come over here to you and introduce myself, and I could say, oh, hi, nice to meet you. Okay. Or I could say, oh, hi, nice to meet you. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference? Oh, absolutely, right? So this association area here, Wernicke's area, takes all of that information and of course, gives you the perception of what just happened. All right, so this is the sensory area. But now where is the motor area? That's the frontal lobe, and there is a special area right here for speech, and that's called Broca's area. So Wernicke's area is sensory, Broca's area is the motor area for speech, and this is where you formulate language, and then that information gets passed on to the primary motor cortex for activating various muscles, maybe for breathing or for articulation. Okay, the limbic system is crucial for emotions, especially aggression. And visual information is input into the limbic system. Okay, the hippocampus is critical for acquiring memory and consolidating short-term memory into long-term memory. So there might be people, maybe you have a grandma or grandpa that knows exactly what happened that morning but can't remember what happened a week ago, okay, because those memories aren't incorporated into long-term memories, and that's a problem of the hippocampus. Okay, what else do I want to say with this one right here? You know, that's almost about everything in this chapter, but I think next time I'll be sure to finish up if there's any other important things for the test. But now, did I tell you when the test was? No. Okay. So before we leave, so we're basically done with Chapter 8. That means we only got to go through the autonomic nervous system. And if you want to get a head start on that this weekend, that would be great. That will make life easier for you next week. Okay. So Monday is the 20th. Tuesday is the 21st. Okay, then the 22nd, 23rd, that's Thursday. So that's next week. So let's have the test on the 27th. Oh, no, that's Monday. We don't meet on the 27th. Okay, that won't work. So we're going to have it on the 28th. Okay. Not a Tuesday? Ooh. Even though you got the scores back the same day? I don't want to have it on the 23rd, because I don't know if that gives you enough time. There are 30 days in October? Are you kidding me? I'm kidding. Okay, so remind me on Tuesday that we're going to have it on the 30th. Okay? All right. So that's the deal.